The fact that this was also framed as a fact-checking exercise is revealing, you know, kind of, because it is really this kind of like up is down, day is night, kind of like moment we're in where language that used to mean one thing now means something the opposite thing, you know? So that's revealing.
You know, if the private sector media wants to traffic in this kind of stuff, that's fine. But when U.S. government-funded media is producing this kind of content, it really sets back U.S. credibility in terms of their ability to legitimately criticize the Chinese for misinformation.
I remember a few weeks ago, there was this debate about in Nigeria, you have so many fake products and everything, how it's flooding the market. And the FCCP at that time did not react. So when you have a scandal like this, you also need to show that, you know, you're doing something, especially when it involves Nigerian being quote-unquote discriminated against in their own countries.
The China in Africa podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Africa-China Reporting Project at Wits University in Johannesburg. The ACRP promotes balanced, considered reporting on China-Africa relations through training programs held throughout the year. More information at AfricaChinaReporting.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the China in Africa podcast, a proud member of the Seneca Podcast Network. I'm Eric Olander, and as always when we do a Week in Review show, I am thrilled to have my two best friends joining me, Jérôme Nima, our Africa editor from Mauritius, and Kobus van Staden joining us from lovely Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good afternoon to both of you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
We've got a very lively show scheduled for today, some very interesting topics. So we're going to talk about the viral video in Nigeria that spawned an enormous amount of anger when a Chinese supermarket was blocking entry to local residents. Again, Kobus, you and I have talked about this over the years. This happened in Zambia a few years ago. That also happened in Kenya many years ago. It's been a while since we've had something like this, but a lot of anger. And interesting, we're going to talk about some governance issues there. Then we're going to talk about a very interesting human rights discussion that happened this week between the African Union and the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And finally, we're going to end on yet again, once again on this show, the debt trap narrative. And this appeared again this week in the media, and I'd like to get your take on my response to a column that was written by U.S. government media. So let's start with this outbreak of anger in the Nigerian capital, Abuja, that happened. It all started earlier this week when some young people went to a supermarket that's within a compound that is owned by the Chinese Chamber of Commerce of Nigeria. Now, very important to kind of set this up properly. It's a gated community which has residential, it has businesses, and it's predominantly a Chinese community that's there. And when some young people went with their cameras to approach the gates to say, I want to go into the supermarket, there were local guards who said, no, you can't come in. And let me just play you some of the video, the sound from the video that set this all off, and you can hear what the young people were recounting about their experience when they tried to enter this supermarket.
Okay, my name is ASG. Currently, we are at the Chinese Chamber Airport Road, Abuja. So we can, I and my friend, we are up to three or four of them. So we are not allowed to enter the Chinese supermarket. So it's not a joke, it's not a lie. We did Abuja right now, we did the place, we showed it right now.
We've been trying to enter the place, maybe no how far. But we heard that now our Nigerian people, now then they sell, baby. They are the ones selling in there. So if we go there, they might lose their job.
I was thinking
we should just go and try to sell for us or not. But the security have explained things to us, and I think it's going to be wise. I don't want our people that are there working. They say even if they sell for us now, it will backfire on them. That's what they said. So we will not go inside the area. We don't want to force ourselves inside the supermarket, so it's not cause issues. So for now, we just confirmed that, okay, we cannot go in as a Nigerian. Okay, they said that from January, they stopped allowing Nigerians to buy things since from January. They cannot enter. It's only for Chinese people. So that's what we have confirmed it, and it's true.
So that's the video that set this all off. And boy, did it go just like wildfire across X and on YouTube and on Facebook. And what was very interesting is that the Federal Competition and Consumer Protection Commission in Nigeria, that's the FCCPC, reacted blazingly fast. I mean, within 24 hours, they were on site. They shuttered the store within 24 hours. And a delegation from the Consumer Protection Bureau was there and explained why this was so important.
Inquiries have shown that, yes, as of this morning, this supermarket was open to discriminate against any person who has any desire, intention to patronize any shop. It's a public shop. It's a public access facility and also business.
So the Consumer Protection Commission then demanded that the owner of that supermarket appear as part of the inquiry. Now, we got an update on Wednesday that the owners did appear. Now, there were rumors circulating on Nigerian social media that the owners had fled, and also some of the broadcasters were talking about that. But let me quote to you from the Consumer Protection Commission. Owners of the Abuja Chinese supermarket facing allegations of discriminatory practices responded to our summons today to answer questions regarding the allegations. FCCPC operatives have conducted an inspection of the facility. Now, interestingly, then the China Chamber of Commerce, they came under just withering criticism because it's within their compound. Now, the secretary of the chamber, Cui Guangzhen, he issued a statement midweek that both helped him but also really hurt him. Let me read you from the statement. The China Chamber of Commerce is one of several enterprises using the facility, and the supermarket in question is located in the residential area of the state, which is unrelated to the China Chamber of Commerce in Nigeria. Now, guys, you think that's okay. That's perfectly legitimate. The chamber had nothing to do with this. This was about the supermarket. However, his statement went on, and this is where he really screwed himself. No individual was subjected to discrimination or denied access to the estate or supermarket to purchase groceries, as widely believed. The China General Chamber of Commerce emphasized its commitment to equality and inclusiveness and welcomed firsthand visits to witness the truth. Well, listen, we have the video. Everybody saw the video that they weren't able to get in. And so this completely undermined the statement. Now, by the end of the week, the story had made its transition from social media onto national television. And it was a major topic on all the breakfast shows in Nigeria and even in the evening news. Let me play you a little bit of the discussion, because I watched a lot of this from one of the broadcasts, and this is featuring an interview with Tunde Abatan, who's the executive editor of the New Dawn Nigeria newspaper, who spoke with TVC News in Nigeria. And you're going to hear the host ask the question that really was on everybody's mind.
You know, Tunde, when I first saw this story, I was wondering, how would this happen? Why would a foreign company, you know, come to my country and deny me access to it? Because simply, I don't understand.
Well, they would do it because a lot of foreign countries have been doing it in the past and getting away with it. There was a time in Lagos, Chinese company in Lagos, they normally lock them inside under inhuman conditions. And when they are going out, they release them as slaves. In fact, in this country, Chinese construction companies will load their staff inside a bus that is not even fit for carrying cows. They load Nigerians inside it and take them to work. And nothing will happen. NLC will go there and picket it, and nothing will happen. So as long as we refuse to take punitive action, even though the decision, the reaction of the FCCP is reactive, it is reactive. Because after the news came out, that was when it did. But I think we have to commend them for taking it.
Yeah, that's really one of the upsides of the story, guys, is the fact that the Consumer Protection Commission responded so effectively, so quickly. And we often talk about weak governance, weak state capacity, particularly in places like Nigeria. That is not the case at what happened here. So far, the government's response has been something that a lot of people have admired. But listen, this is where I want to start our discussion today. what really is in many respects a very minor incident of, in terms of one store behaving terribly, not necessarily representative of all Chinese in Nigeria or all Chinese in Africa, but certainly exploded into something much deeper and touched some very painful exposed nerves within the Nigeria body politic. Giro, let's get your take on this in terms of the pain that a lot of people were feeling about how can you come to my country and do this to me when, in fact, if I did that in China, you know people would lose their bloody minds if this happened in China. Okay? And there was that sense of outrage that really filtered through a lot of the discussion.
Yes, I believe that was the main element behind that frustration that people had, because there is that background of, first of all, we still have that background of the tension that happened in China between Nigeria and Chinese during the COVID time and everything. We also have the many criticisms that we've been seeing all over the continent, you know, about Chinese human rights and how they deal with workers in their companies. And then you have small issues like this. I'll call it small because it's not about a big company, it's not about a big shop or like a big mall that we do have somewhere in the center of Abuja, just a small shop somewhere, as you see, in a compound somewhere. But because of the magic of social media now, with all those videos going viral, it really touched people into heart, and it really touched those open wounds they still have about, you know, the presence of how foreigners are behaving in Nigeria or even in any other country. So people really felt really insulted, very like, how you come in my country? I was watching those shows that you mentioned, like people like, how do you come in my country, behave like this and treat me like this and everything? And really people went all over the place really expressing their frustration, their anger and everything. Personally, I wouldn't say it's not a big of a deal, but I think it's a big and it's not a big of a deal at the same time. And you kind of wonder why the FCCPC reacted quite fast. I think it was because of the magic of social media. Since the video went viral, they had to do something. They had to show something, you know, because I remember a few weeks ago, there was this debate about in Nigeria, you have so many fake products and everything, how it's flooding the market. And the FCCP at that time did not react. So when you have a scandal like this, you also need to show that, you know, you're doing something, especially when it involves Nigerians being quote-unquote discriminated against in their own country. So it was both a communication operation that took the opportunity also to show something, also to act on something. For me, I would be much more interested to see what was the outcome of all these inquiries, what really transpired behind that situation. I'm much more interested in why they were not allowed, when they did not allow these people to visit the shop. Because when you watch the video, when you watch how it happened, you kind of wonder, how did they even know there was a shop there? Because there's no big names outside, there was a shop here. But somehow they knew there was a shop there. For me, there was so many questions I want to understand before, you know, because in this time of social media and everything, things don't always appear the way they're supposed to. So I think we need to have much more clarity on that, to have a clear opinion on really what transpired in that situation.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, like, it raises a lot of questions. Like, I have some questions about what the kind of spatial configuration was like in that compound. So not to self-promote, but like a few years ago, I co-edited a book about anxiety in Johannesburg. And crime anxiety, of course, is very high in Johannesburg. And petty theft is a big issue in large African cities in many countries. So what you have in Johannesburg, and I assume, I'm guessing also in Abuja, is that many of these small shops would have security gates. And so what you have in South Africa is you kind of hover around the security gate and then the person inside buzzes you in. That's very standard in many small shops in South Africa, and it's used as a form of access control and kind of and crime control. But it obviously opens the door to clear discrimination, and by simple visual discrimination, particularly if one happens to run a Chinese supermarket, which another question I have about this is whether the supermarket was selling specifically Chinese products and therefore, you know, kind of whether they were assuming that they mostly going to be selling to a Chinese clientele. So you can see how visual discrimination immediately becomes kind of like locked in there, you know, immediately.
No. I mean, I can tell you all about this supermarket, even though I haven't been there, because I know these very well from Chinese immigrant communities in many parts of the world. You have them in Johannesburg, you have them in Mauritius, you have them in Nairobi, you have them in San Francisco and Los Angeles. And what it is that, and this is my speculation as to what's going on, and pure speculation, and not meant, by the way, to excuse any of the behavior. Okay, I want to make this very, very clear. But here's what I think happened, and I'd like to get your take on it. This is a store that caters to a very local migrant community with very specialized products of Chinese goods that most people are not familiar with. It's not their favorite taste and whatnot. There's some maybe locals that would be interested in it, but for the most part, it is catering to immigrant communities. By the way, if you go to some parts of Queens in New York, there are exactly the same stores catering to Nigerians, that they have their home products, their foods, all of the things that they miss from home and that they want to cook. No suggesting that the stores in Queens necessarily discriminate against anybody, but those immigrant food stores are very common around the world. My guess, and after having seen this in a number of different cities, is that they said they probably don't speak English very well, the staff. They're immigrant Chinese, so it was difficult for them to communicate. My guess is there's a perception that if they let locals in, there's a greater chance of shoplifting that they can't control. That's my guess is their fear. And so they said, you know what? Is this for Chinese only? Because it's easier for them to be able to deal with that community. That's my speculation.
Yeah, I mean, I totally can see that. But of course, in the bigger scheme, it just causes them so many more problems. There's a Chinese specialty store that I go to very often in a part of Johannesburg. And that one doesn't happen to have that kind of access control that I mentioned. You know, it's just an open shop. And it is interesting that even though it only really kind of specializes in Chinese products, but the majority of the clientele are South African. You know, like South Africans love Chinese food.
But that's a different store. That's serving a different community in that respect.
Maybe, but in general, I think that store still is very Chinese community facing. Just by the optics of the store, the design of the store, it looks like a store in Beijing. But the majority of people who shop there are actually South Africans. And I think middle classes around the world love Asian food. When I was in Berlin, like my partner joked that vegan Asian food is now a form of white food. Like it's a genre of white food. It's just like something called vegan Asian food. You know,
don't say that out here, by the way, in Asia. That is like, I'm just cringing actually listening to you say that.
But you know what I mean? It's actual Asian food, but with all of the fish sauce, all of the many of the ingredients like excised, you know, kind of for a non-Chinese palate. And you know, that's the dominant style in Germany, at least. But my bigger point is that a vogue for Asian food is a middle-class staple across the world. Right? Kind of like everyone loves sushi. Like middle class people love sushi. They love dumplings. And what I mean is that they are missing a very fundamental kind of opportunity to not only expand their market, but to also have some kind of like localization, right? And they super miss that goal.
For me to get back a bit on the case of the video that really, really started the debate is like, when you watch the video, I don't know, from the portion I've watched of that video, of those social media, the video went viral, I didn't see a Chinese stopping the Nigeria going in.
No, it was the guard. It was the guard. And remember, she said, we didn't want to get the guard fired, which I thought was very humane.
Exactly. And which is also interesting because when you know the dynamic of security guard in Africa, they have a certain zeal when they do the job that sometimes you wonder, have you been told not to let us in, or you assumed because it's a Chinese shop that us Nigerians are not allowed to go in? So now the question may be, have the guard been told expressly that you don't let Nigeria come in, or the guard himself assumed that, you know, because it's a Chinese shop and where it's located, you don't have a big name out there telling you this is a shop. The way it's located, you're like, how those guys knew there was a shop here? What they come doing here? Maybe the guard assumed that, you know, I'm not gonna let them in. And then it went all that. That's why I say in my intervention that we need to have much of a background too, because when it comes to those kind of issues, it's really sensitive and we can really, really easy conflate things that are not there or they might there. And as you said, Eric, I don't want to excuse any behavior that may transpire here, but I think that there is a need of larger context to understand how things unfold, because the reality is when it comes to social media, people don't always tell you how they get where they got there, how they found that, how they found that shop, how they don't give you all those background to allow you to kind of say, what am I looking at beside the emotion that you are telling us, that you are showing us here?
So the issue has now jumped to Abuja in the House of Representatives. Not surprising at all.
Yeah.
Let me give you some feedback here from Representative Jafaru Yakubu, who is the chairman of the House Committee on China-Nigeria Parliamentary Friendship Group, and the spokesperson of the House, Honorable Akin Rotimi, who both condemned any form of discrimination in a statement. Let me read you part of that statement. As a committee tasked with fostering positive and mutually beneficial relations between Nigeria and China, we want to emphasize that such discriminatory practices, if substantiated by relevant authorities, goes against the principles of friendship and cooperation that our two countries have worked hard to cultivate over the years. Kobus, this brings me back to 4 or 5 years ago, and the House of Representatives, if you recall, took on the issue of the Chinese debt trap narrative, that also that Nigeria was being sold out in these contracts, and remember all of that. And one of the things was that it really took the China debt issue in Nigeria way out of proportion relative to the share that China has of Nigeria's total debt, which is around 2-3%. Very, very small share. But it's interesting that they were starting to equate Nigeria and China state-to-state relations from something that happened at a local level with a supermarket. And again, one who did something bad, and now all of a sudden it's becoming this state-to-state thing. And I just think that's a little bit... But again, these are politicians. They're looking for headlines. They saw that this made national news. Politicians are the same everywhere. If they can get their name in the news, they're going to get their name in the news. And this was a great way to do it. But this does risk exploding into something bigger. Just very quickly before we end, and I'll get your final comments from both of you before we move on. The Chinese embassy has not said anything. Normally, the Chinese embassies do release these statements saying, we want Chinese nationals to respect the laws. We also hope that local authorities will follow procedures and the law and treat everybody fairly. The Chinese embassy in Abuja has been suspiciously quiet all week. Again, a little bit out of character. They're probably waiting to see how this thing unfolds. But it is now emerging up out of being a local issue into an international issue. Very quickly, because we're short on time. Jiro, final thoughts on this, and what are you looking for next on it? And then same to you, Kobus.
I'm not sure the Chinese embassy would react, especially since it's only an isolated case. They surely have many Chinese shops in Abuja, in all over Nigeria, where they did not report such incident happening. So I think they don't want to react in a way that they don't want to blow the issue out of proportion. Personally, I do think it's a very isolated issue. There was no need actually to go all over the place with our representative and everything. And I'm really quite sad. I'm much more waiting for the full context of the story to really put everything back in its way. It was so people understood if it was an isolated case, we address it and we move forward.
For me, it gives an interesting kind of glimpse of, and in that sense, it connects to the debt conversation that you mentioned before, of how China plays this special role. China's this kind of site of contestation in academic terms, you know, kind of it's like this kind of like area, this kind of inflamed area that everyone is interested in. China has that particular kind of role in a lot of African conversations where any small Chinese kind of problem is then immediately tends to kind of be seen as emblematic of the entire relationship. And that is just a very kind of like interesting dynamic. And I think Nigeria is a particularly kind of like interesting case study in there because it has such a robust media. So it picks up on these kind of scandals very quickly and then it gets elevated very quickly. You know, so it's a great example of that kind of the, like a weird media weirdness in action.
And that's important, both what Jiro and what Kobus said. I'm going to kind of merge the two and to put these instances in context. We are talking about a Chinese community in the continent of Africa that numbers in the hundreds and hundreds of thousands. This kinds of incidents do not happen very often. In fact, the last time we've seen something like this was 4 or 5 years ago. And I think it's important to remember there are ignorant, stupid in every country, in every part of the world, from every place. So again, I'm not trying to justify, but I know what's going to happen here, Kobus and Jiro, is that when we talk about this, people are going to very, very selectively pick stories from 7 years ago in Zambia and from, you know, 8 years ago in Kenya, an anecdote from Kinshasa and this one thing here and say, see, all the Chinese in Africa are terrible and they do this. And I think that is a terrible mistake as well. So just want to make sure that everybody has a reminder to keep these things in context. Very important. Now, on a related note, very interesting, also this week, diplomats from China and the African Union met as part of a regular dialogue series that they have on human rights. Now, that got my attention because anytime the Chinese do things on human rights over the world, anywhere in the world, it's kind of interesting. Now, they met on Monday at AU headquarters in Addis Ababa, and this is from the AU statement on terms of what the objectives were. They want to, quote, make concrete recommendations to pressing human rights concerns in both regions. So the presumption there is that the AU gets to reflect on Chinese human rights and the Chinese get to reflect on human rights in Africa. Now, there is no indication whatsoever in any of the readouts that the AU brought up sensitive issues like Tibet or that they call now Xinjiang or the Uyghurs in Xinjiang or any of those red line issues that are incredibly sensitive. And there's no indication whatsoever that the reverse was done either. Now, very interesting in the readouts from the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs, their readout was like literally one line. We met, that's it, thank you. And they had some nice pictures and that was it. The African Union readout of the meeting was much, much longer. And buried deep in the AU's statement was a very interesting reference by the AU's top diplomat for governance and conflict prevention. Her name is Patience Chiradze. And let me just quote you from their statement. She said that apparently Chiradze emphasized the importance of raising awareness among stakeholders from China on the work of China on the principles that safeguard the rights of African peoples, particularly in business conduct. That was very interesting. That stood out to me. And it stood out to me because you almost never even hear even a veiled criticism of the Chinese or even a hint of any type of disagreement when you're talking about the AU-China relationship. Giraud, am I being too sensitive because I'm so close to the story? Or did that statement also register with you?
Of course, that statement really caught my attention, like that small one-line comment. And it's even caught my attention more because when you put side by side a Chinese readout of that same meeting, you realize that, yes, there was something that
one side wanted to say something and another side didn't.
Exactly, exactly. Which means that one side did not really like that comment made and they did not want to reflect it in their own readout of the meeting. So yes, that really stood out to me in the sense of like, I think that it was an opportunity for her to raise that question of with China. Need authorities to tell them, you know, you should pay much more attention because we cannot keep on just, you know, putting it on the rug. The fact that you have many complaints, you go from north to south to West Africa, you have the same complaint coming in over and over. And here we don't have the case of one small isolated business somewhere. We have the name, we have big names, big companies, big industries where you have those complaints coming in over and over. The reports, the human rights reports and everything, the NGOs reports in French and English coming all over from the continent. Where at some point you have to say, you know, guys, you really need to address that issue on the way you treat local employees. And it reminds me of the discussion that we had a few months back with, I think you had a guest talking about the Chikku culture. Maybe you need to address the way you think the employment works in Africa. It's time for you to start being much more in sync, in phase with local laws and regulation and treat people well. Because when you don't do that, it's becoming a real problem. Next time, I think those issues might become much more prominent issues on the table. And I'm wondering, since you mentioned it during an AU-China-Africa meeting on human rights, I'm quite curious to see if we're going to see the same topic coming out of the next FOCAC meeting, though.
The reference was quite vague, you know, kind of. So I was wondering exactly what they meant, because it seemed to imply worker relations and worker welfare, you know, kind of, which is with that kind of abuse of African workers on Chinese work sites has been an issue for years and years. But it also kind of leaves open the base for that it has an ESG component as well, you know, kind of where it seems to leave open the space to include communities around work sites, for example, which is its own whole problem.
Yeah, I don't think that was it. This was specifically about human rights. And so this is not about environmental in that respect. So I suspect that it had to do with labor rights.
But the point, obviously, of the wider Chinese human rights focus is that it is so focused on socioeconomic rights, right? Kind of rather than civil and political rights. You know, that is the human rights kind of, you know, approach. So in that sense, that criticism coming from the AU is notable, I think. And again, like, you know, kind of it's vague enough that there seems to be a lot packed in there. And so I'm very interested to hear more about what was actually being discussed there.
We probably will not hear more about what was discussed because this is just the way it is. But it's very important to note that these diplomatic readouts that are published on the official website, so this is not a news report covering it. This is an AU press statement summarizing the media. The language is very, very considered. They don't just quickly write these things and then just willy-nilly put them out. So I think that there was a... And they said specifically business conduct. So that could be governance. Remember, she's the head of governance too. So there could be corruption issues. It could speak to labor issues. But the fact that they expressed some concern about Chinese business practices in Africa is something that in the 15 years we've been doing this show, Kobus, I've never seen before at the AU level. And what I took away from this, and I think this is very interesting, and someone like Folashade Sule at Oxford University would be able to tell us more about this, is the stronger agency that stakeholders in Africa, particularly at the AU, have in the negotiating process with the Chinese at all levels. We've been hearing about this in terms of the agenda for the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation Summit, where African embassies in Beijing are pushing back a lot more. And that's the context that I put this in, is that there is much more confidence on the African side to start asserting themselves and driving this relationship with China more. Final thoughts to you guys.
Well, you know, kind of I hope so. Like the AU taking on that role would be great. I'm maybe not holding my breath.
Fair enough. But even a little bit of progress is progress nonetheless.
Yeah, you know, kind of, I think one thing that the Nigerian example, you know, showed is that it is possible for a national government to kind of make a big splash around these issues and to gain a lot of kind of political traction from that. And we've seen in the past that if recipient governments, if they have regulation in place and if they like impose that regulation, then the Chinese play ball, right, generally, you know, particularly around environmental, social, socioeconomics kind of and worker rights issues. So I think that is probably still in the African context where the rubber hits the road rather than at the AU level. But the AU mentioning it at all is notable.
For me, what really surprised me the most is like when you look at Patience Zanelli Shiradza background, she's from Zimbabwe. And when you look at how Zimbabwe is close to China, and when you know how much country has influence over the diplomat at AU level, you kind of know the kind of certain diplomat will not say certain things towards certain country based on the relationship they do have with that specific country. That's why a statement really stood out to me, because I was like, wow, that it was really surprising. And I really don't know if maybe it was a personal note you wanted to put in there, or it was the AU idea behind. I would not assume that because it's AU that you always have a well-thought process behind on what they need to say or not, because you also have certain diplomats that has certain leeway on the way they can speak about those, all those kind of issues. So for me, it's like a background, and the context of all of it really kind of caught my attention. I don't really expect that to become a topic of discussion following
up.
It was just notable. It's notable. It really should not pay attention. But if it comes a second time from a second person or from yourself, then I think we should really, really start to pay attention that maybe the discussion are starting to raise somewhere.
I think we should also like kind of look out if there's more of these kind of mentions from the AU, right? Kind of because we recently saw the AU, you know, kind of suggesting or, you know, kind of announcing a kind of continent-wide, you know, ban on donkey skin trade with China, right? So that was
Well, they didn't make that specifically with China. They didn't mention China.
Well, not China, but China is the world's biggest market.
Exactly. But that was implied.
So that's an interesting kind of data point. And this is now a second interesting data point around this. So it'll be interesting to see if there's more of these.
And you remember in our conversation with Joseph Asunka, who is the CEO of Afrobarometer, that one of the things that he was forecasting is that as Chinese economic engagement with Africa goes down because lending is going down and whatnot, that there might be some stronger negative views of China that would emerge, you know, from various different stakeholders. Not suggesting that there's a linkage there, but just something that we might want to think about. And just to kind of round out our discussion, that this issue of challenging work environments with Chinese companies is not something that is unique to Africa and not something unique to the People's Republic of China. There is an amazing story on the website Rest of World by Viola Zhou. And Kobus, remember we interviewed Viola. She covers China Tech in Hong Kong. She did an absolutely amazing story. If she doesn't get a Pulitzer for this, I'll be disappointed. On Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, TSMC, who is trying to build a massive chip plant in Phoenix in the American desert. The story is TSMC's debacle in the American desert. And I just want to read you guys a line here, and this is what we've heard in the African context quite a bit. The American engineers complained of rigid, counterproductive hierarchies at the company. Taiwanese TSMC veterans described their American counterparts as lacking this kind of dedication and obedience they believe to be the foundation of their company's world-leading success. And it goes on to say that Americans are lazy, they want all this time off, they don't want to work 24 hours a day. And so, I mean, again, and I will tell you from my own firsthand experience, I used to work for a Taiwanese company. It is brutal. So these issues that we're seeing in Africa are not unique to Africans, nor are they unique to Chinese companies, but also ethnically Chinese companies. And Taiwanese companies are also having similar problems, and not just in Africa, but also in places like the US and Europe as well.
Let's face it, the work culture in many Asian countries differs to a lot of parts of the world. They're quite much stricter than many of us.
And I can say that from here in Vietnam, it's a pretty tough work culture as well. Again, very hierarchical in that way. And Kobus, you lived in Japan, so I think you can relate to that as well. Okay, I mean, I'm sorry to keep bringing this story back up again. And I know some of our listeners are going to be like, gee, are you really going to be talking about this again? But anyway, just quickly want to address it because it's just laughable to me. So this story headline, China's global lending lures countries into a debt trap. Naturally, that caught my attention. And it was written by a site called polygraph.info. Have you guys heard of polygraph.info?
I looked it up after seeing the article. Yeah.
Me too. Okay, so let me read just for everybody who's not interested or not familiar with polygraph.info. Okay, so on the about page, polygraph.info is produced by the fact-checking team of the Voice America News Center. Okay, headquartered in Washington, D.C., VOA broadcasts in 48 languages to more than 326 million people around the world each week. This is the U.S. state-backed media. So it's a fact-checking website, which is what made this even more delicious. So I wrote a column, a short little column on LinkedIn that went slightly viral about it, just kind of saying, how ironic. Irony is apparently not dead that a fact-checking website completely got their facts wrong. So let me just read you a couple elements from this polygraph.info article, which, by the way, was anonymously written, unauthored. At least two countries, Zambia and Sri Lanka, have gone into default and declared bankruptcy, mainly due to their inability to pay high interest rates on their debts to China. Which, of course, we know is not true, that Zambia defaulted on its Eurobond debt. And Kobus, as you and I spoke with a pair of researchers in Sri Lanka, who said that it was the Eurobond debt that forced them into near default. I don't think Sri Lanka defaulted, but forced them into renegotiation. The evidence is not there to support that statement. And then here's another one. China's massive global infrastructure project, the Belt and Road Initiative, has played a pivotal role when it comes to debt traps. Zambia borrowed from Chinese state-owned banks over the last 20 years to renovate its dams, subway systems, and roads. At the end of 2020, Zambia declared bankruptcy. Again, no mention of the private bondholder debt that precipitated the declaration of bankruptcy. So what I did on LinkedIn is I said, there's no other way to explain a story like this. When I pointed out the fact that Chatham House, Boston University, Johns Hopkins University, the University of Colombo, and even Bloomberg Television have all published reports, detailed reports that debunk the debt trap narrative. The Center for Global Development in Washington has also done something on it. Aid Data has also done something on it. It comes up on the first or second page of a Google search. So to your point, Kobus, there is no possible way that a site that is purportedly a fact-checking website can publish an article like this and not find that information on the first or second page of a Google search result. And so the only conclusion one can make is that this is intentional misinformation meant to malign China. That's the only takeaway one can have, by the way, by a government-backed media outlet.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that this was also framed as a fact-checking exercise is revealing, you know, kind of, because it is really this kind of like up is down, day is night, kind of like moment we're in where language that used to mean one thing now means something the opposite thing, you know. So that's revealing. I mean, it also quoted Samantha Power, the head of USAID, you know, kind of making this point. And it's like, remember the days when Samantha Power used to be some kind of moral authority? It's long gone. You know, kind of like several issues within her quote. Kind of, so for example, she also completely left out the entire financial industry in New York and London that channels significant money into the US tax bucket and into Democratic, you know, kind of pockets. She also mentioned that the vast majority of US aid, because she made the point that China lends a lot and doesn't give a lot of aid, and that the US gives a lot more aid. Of course, she left out the fact that 75% of that aid never leaves the U.S. borders. You know, kind of it circulates within U.S. companies. So, you know, which doesn't make it worthless, but also doesn't make it as significant as she mentions.
And also a considerable amount of U.S. aid, classified as aid, is in the form of military support as well. So something to also think about.
Yes, that little detail too, yeah. So it's all so funny to see in action. So funny.
So the point that I was making, Giraud, was it is well documented that China engages in mass-scale misinformation campaigns, particularly targeted at its rivals in the U.S., in Australia, now in the Philippines. Massive cyber operations. Again, well documented. You don't have to take my word for it. There's tons of third-party studies that have just tracked everything that the Chinese are doing on Facebook, on X, and other ways of really sending out awful amounts of disinformation and misinformation. My point was that the United States loses the moral credibility when its own state-backed media entities are also engaging in the same way.
Exactly. And it was really funny reading that column. And just after reading it, a few hours later, I was having a conversation that's going to be online once this podcast will be on, when I was interviewing Paul Nantulia, who published a report about Chinese media influence in Africa. And at some point, I asked him about what the difference between what China does in terms of media influence and also what the Western media are doing in Africa. He gave his answers. But this case just came and to highlight the fact that you also have those state media. This is not even propaganda. This is pure disinformation and misinformation. You're like, guys, I mean, I think we talked about it. I said, I don't know if it's pure laziness or if it's really active misinformation at this point. Because you are like, guys, as you said in your column, it's like the information is like very at the very first three searches when you do on Google search, you find the answers there. But somehow people go and, I mean, produce a paper like this and it's gonna go. And those kind of story, because they have no author, they're gonna be republished by other content and everything, because it's coming from Polygraph that's supported by VOA. It's gonna become a self-narrative on itself. It's gonna, you know, resurrect again. People are going to talk about it again. They're gonna be citing the same and over the same example that have been debunked over and so many times. So yes, they're losing the moral authority to come and say, criticizing what CGTN or what Radio China International does in Africa. They cannot do that anymore. They cannot do that. And plus, when you take all the context of the current geopolitical context, the Israel-Gaza situation, how the governments are reacting, everything, it's even weakens more and more the Western voices in that space in the global south. You cannot be coming and talking to us about true information while you guys are really actively doing misinformation and disinformation.
Listen, I know we have a lot of State Department folks who listen to the show. We have quite a few people in the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs who also listen to the show. If I was in the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs on the U.S. desk, what I would do is take this article and I would hold it up and I would say, you're accusing us of state-backed media disinformation, and here we go, Exhibit A. And if I was in the State Department, who with any amount of pull, I would call up my good friends over at the Voice of America and I'd say, this kind of thing sets us back. It really sets us back. It does not help us. You know, if the private sector media wants to traffic in this kind of stuff, that's fine. But when U.S. government funded media is producing this kind of content, it really sets back U.S. credibility in terms of their ability to legitimately criticize the Chinese for misinformation.
I mean, definitely, sure. But I think Joe Biden himself has used the debt trap.
That is true. That is true.
So this is well-established messaging from the U.S. government now.
I mean, and recently, by the way, it was just earlier this year that Joe Biden, with Latin American leaders, made a reference to the debt trap off of a speech, by the way. So it was written by and prepared by his handlers. It was not just an off-the-cuff comment that he made.
Yeah, so the U.S. government's claim to be always be speaking the truth on this issue, I think, is also, that ship has sailed, you know?
Well, there's different parts of the U.S. government here, because we know that some parts of the government get it. They understand it. Other parts do not. And so the U.S. government, like the Chinese government, is a massive institution and organization that does not align itself at all times on all things. So just to be fair there.
And I wanted to mention the case of AFRICOM General last time we had a show about it. The fact to mention that for the first time, he did not mention that. He also skipped that part of, you know, the debt trap that was, you know, a line of communication they've been using for the last 3-4 years in Congress. But this time around, he did not mention it. He just, you know, went over it. So it means that the messaging is getting a certain part of the administration are understanding that, like, okay, that we should move over, we should pass that. But a certain part believe that when we need to push a bit, we still can push it forward. And because, let's remember that, because it's the United States, and when Joe Biden says that, you have many people in the global south that say, wow, if the US are saying that, it means that they certainly must have something, they certainly must know something about it, so it's gotta be true. It's gotta be true. So that's why I think at some point I don't really worry.
You're giving a lot of credibility to the United States and the global south today, which I'm not entirely sure is warranted here.
I don't think it's warranted at all, but they do, and that's unfortunate. And that's why those kind of narratives are still able to spread.
Well, you know, kind of one of the nature of US power, right, and Western power, one of the aspects of it is that for the rest of us, for big parts of the global south, it kind of sets the horizon of how we know our world, right? Kind of like, I know that there is a refugee crisis on the border of Myanmar because I read the New York Times, right? So that has been really fundamental to their power, but I think that power is really eroding. It's eroding very, very quickly. And this is an example of the erosion, I think.
That's the discourse power that they talk about. So let's leave our conversation there, gentlemen. Thank you so much. If you would like to find out more about what these two are doing, join us every day on the China Global South Project. We have this amazing service that's out there. I'm just so proud of everything that they're doing, including our teams here in Asia, as well as in the Middle East. We're pretty much the only ones doing this, particularly in French and in Arabic. Giro is producing a daily French service. He has two emails a week that goes out. He's also recording podcasts. And we are building state-of-the-art research projects. We're about to launch a brand new database of nickel mining in Indonesia that tracks all Chinese nickel mines. Giro is updating his amazing, groundbreaking cobalt supply chain interactive data set that will come out with 2023 data in about a month. Month and a half?
Yeah, it's about a month and a half, yeah.
Okay. We're also going to be launching new products on China-Africa energy mapping all across the continent. People haven't done this before, but we can't do this without your support. I want to do a big thank you to all of our current subscribers, and just I can't tell you how much it means to us. Also, our Patreon supporters as well. You guys are so important to us. And so we would love for you to join our reader community. Go to chinaglobalsouth.com/subscribe. You can sign up for monthly or annual subscriptions, and we'll give you 30 days for free. If you are a student, you can just email me, eric@chinaglobalsouth.com, or a teacher, and I will make sure that to send you the half off discount links. So that'll do it for this edition of the show. For Jeronima in Mauritius and Kobus in Johannesburg, I'm Eric Olander. Thank you so much for listening.
The discussion continues online. Tag us on Twitter @ChinaGSProject and visit us at ChinaGlobalSouth.com. If you speak French, check out our full coverage at ProjetAfriqueChine.com and AfriqueChine on Twitter. That's Afrique with a K. And you'll also find links to our sites and social media channels in Arabic.